Tonight I want to speak about the seventh fear that we have brought up in this series of talks. And this one is on the fear of death, the fear of being, of not being. I sort of saved this one for the last because I know it's it contains many, many, many psychological, spiritual, and physical issues that arise when this subject is brought up. In fact, it's amazing when you're working with the dying how all the unresolved issues at the end of one's life come forward when they know that they're going to die. Psychological, spiritual issues, physical issues, everything. And so when we bring up this issue, the subject of death and dying, it offers us a chance to expose all of our unresolved complaints and arguments with life. And so this particular talk is meant to drive that forward, to really be able to focus in and see what is left unfinished in our physical, mental, and spiritual experience. Before I get to the topic, though, I just want to mention, I know Steve Armstrong did a talk on the Four Noble Truths a couple of weeks ago, which I appreciated a lot. When we're talking about fear, it takes the it goes from the general to the specific. It's important to have a cognitive map of the spiritual landscape, and that's what the Four Noble Truths are. But that map needs to be translated into specifics of our life, so that the roadmap becomes the actual place, time and place of the arising of problems within our life. If we make it too abstract, if we keep it too cognitive, if we just keep it as a map, a philosophical map, then it provides some sense of support and some appropriate measurement of contentment. But it doesn't get to the specifics of our life. It really doesn't. It has to integrate into the hard realities that we live with. So as we go along in this talk, I'm just going to bring forth the Eightfold Path in relationship, or the Four Noble Truths in relationship to this particular topic. Certainly, the first of those truths is that there is conflict and struggle. And I don't think that there's a topic that brings forth more struggle for most people than the topic of our death or demise. In fact, it's the fear of annihilation on the physical, mental, and spiritual level that really is one of the core issues that lead forth to other fears. And extrapolation from this issue leads forth to other fears as well. The fear of stillness, for instance, the fear of being negated, the fear of abandonment, the fear of not being. And so we're going to look at this topic, from this topic, from the physical implications, psychological implications, and the spiritual implications, and how we distort reality because of our fear of this particular fact, an event in existence, which is death. Now, that distortion of reality is the second noble truth. That is, that we, when we come to a hard, conflictual area in ourself or in life, we distort it. We deny it. We pretend that there's another reality. And that pretension, that covering over or distancing ourselves from the actual fact is what the cause of suffering, how the cause of suffering is created, the second noble truth. And then at some point, as we begin to line ourselves up to the, may I use the word, beauty in, that death holds for us, and it's a freedom, the access of spaciousness, that when we enter this topic, it doesn't seem to hold, but actually does hold an enormous sense of liberation. And so, and the third noble truth in regards to this topic is bringing it to bear on all the ways, allowing it to have its justifiable impact on all aspects of our life, and to honor its impact, and to work with life as that being a main ingredient of life. And then, of course, how do we do that? Well, that's the fourth noble truth, or the Eightfold Path. Essentially, the Eightfold Path can be summarized, and I hope I'm not offering a McDonald's approach to the Eightfold Path, but basically it means showing up in body, speech, and mind. Showing up for this thing. Showing up for our life. In fact, we hide in the realm of the abstract, in the realm of thought, in the realm of pretension, in the realm of denial, and all the other defense mechanisms, blame, rationalization, because we're afraid of the event, what the event means about us. And when we're talking about death and dying, it means a lot about us. In fact, the fear is that it's going to take us away. It's going to annihilate us. The fear of the ending of me is basically what this fear is about. So to show up for that, to actually, you know, to be present for this topic, and to honor its importance by not arguing with it internally, letting it have its say. You might let it have it. It's already doing that. It's just that we're pretending as if it isn't around. Denying transition, denying the flux and change of situations, the impermanence of things, is essential denial of death. And it doesn't serve us to do that. We don't understand that until we actually experience the reality in which death is a part. Then we understand how it serves us. Until that point, it just, all it represents to me is the absence of me. And you know, as we, in Dharma practice, we're really journeying into the truth of this particular topic. And we'll, another way to frame Dharma practice is we journey into the terror, or through the terror of selflessness. That's why Dharma holds such reactivity at some stages, such fear at some stages of it, because it represents the death of the mental image of me, the mentally derived sense of I. And we feel that that's all we've got, and so we put an enormous amount of credibility into an abstraction. And as we journey into the Dharma and we see and experience the truth of death arising in each and every moment, and that there is no one that is holding steady in the face of this subject of death and dying. In fact, the rising and falling of me and the passing of me over time is the ever-present truth that Dharma begins to honor. Shows us that this topic has a safety valve in it, and the safety valve is the relaxation in relationship to it. It's just the willingness to open to life, regardless of the conditions of life, which means the conditions of birth and death. Now, there can be such a dread around this topic. I was doing a workshop in Vancouver, and I noticed in the middle of the workshop a young woman got up and suddenly just left the room. She emailed me after I got back home to Seattle, and she said, you know, this workshop that you did brought up so much dread that I just could not stay in my seat any longer. And so I appreciate the enormous reserve of fear that many of us have in relationship to this topic. But when are we going to address it? When are we going to step forward into it? Are we going to stay behind the blindfold of our dread, protected, seemingly protected, while the earth and the world and ourselves age, and while change is forever happening? We just shut our eyes like a three-year-old and pretend the world isn't there. So we can get locked into that dread, or we can begin to stay on the cutting edge, so that we're the growing edge of that, so that we're growing in relationship to the truth and the facts as they really are. Another interesting story. I was picked up in Kansas City when I was doing a retreat there. And I was picked up by a man, and on the way to the retreat center from the airport, he said that he had just been released from prison after 27 years. And he's a little man, and he said that every day before he went out into the exercise yard, he would pump himself up from the fear and dread of what it meant to go outside there and be bullied by the other prisoners. And he would pump himself up in reaction to the dread and hold himself very tight and with a lot of macho energy. And then he would walk out, and that persona, I guess, would keep people from picking on him. Well, 27 years later, he gets out of prison, and he is the janitor of a school system. And there's no threat at all now, either environmentally around him or in his job. But every morning when he gets up with that dread. He gets up with the fear of those 27 years and the impact of those 27 years. And I bring this story up because if we live with the dread of fear for the decades of our life, then life starts taking on that dread. The conditioned way that we hold death eventually generalizes out to how we hold life itself. And many of us wonder why we have such pervasive anxiety. Some of us don't have the object of our fear any longer. It's been melted into kind of a generalized anxiety about living itself. And sometimes this anxiety has its base, its origins, in our relationship to death and dying. And if we have that, we have to re-own the subject again, to bring back the subject, to heal to the area of that. Not that we're going to, at some point, be completely fearless of death, although I think that's certainly on the Dharma path. But you begin to feel like you're shedding layers of armor in relationship to life, that you aren't afraid to live, basically. I know when I was a new Dharma student, I was doing one of my first three-month courses at IMS, and I was sitting in an early morning sitting, and I had the experience, the memory, although it felt physical, of having died. And I knew it wasn't happening to this body, but I could feel all the physical implications of the experience in the body. And my chest started to squeeze tight, so I knew I was having a heart attack. And I had the fear and dread of what that meant. And I knew I was dying. And then I died. And the moment after I died, I realized that the fear had been so strong that I was not awake, I wasn't alive for my own death, which, of course, in Dharma practice, we all want to be wide awake in that moment. And so I came out of that experience with, it was before my hospice work, with a great deal of humility in the face of this subject. It's not an easy one for almost all of us, but it's one that we have to keep pushing our sense of contraction around. We have to keep stepping out of that contraction and walking into life so that it can teach us what it needs to teach us, so that we can be awake. Okay, so let's look at the implications of physical death and show how physical death draws us into some sense of false assumptions about life and our dependency upon it. You know, when we talk about physical death, we begin to get a sense that we are not in control. And I think one of the great teachings of death is who is really in control, or what is really in control, is a better way of saying it. I mean, we have lived from our birth until our death as if we had certain influence and impact upon life, and that we can then have an impact or an influence or a sense of control on our death as well. Well, I think death shatters that assumption. And in fact, physical death, I was a young social worker working with a very, very wealthy individual in Houston, a multi-million dollar home and servants. And she was dying in the foyer of her very large mansion, barking orders and giving instructions and being in control, even as her body was withering away to the point where she couldn't lift her hand to shout instructions any longer. And I just remember thinking her default position was to try even harder at control. All she knew in life was how to control it. She had never really ever relaxed and had any faith in the process of life at all, and that she was going to die defaulting to the only position she knew. And it was so sad to see this once very elegant woman become so traumatized and isolated in her own self through her need to control her outcome. So I use that as an example. You know, death, it shows us the laws of the universe, and it also shows us the false assumptions we make about those laws, and certainly the belief in our control and empowerment and will is one that death questions. It also questions whether life is as predictable as we believe it to be, whether it follows the fairness issues, whether it follows the rules of order that we have set out in our culture. When you look at what death does, it doesn't follow that. It doesn't. That oftentimes, a child will die before his or her parents, which is not in our fairness script. And we blame for that. We don't realize that life doesn't hold fairness as a way to be. It doesn't have rules of order and governance according to our rational and logical, culturally imposed rules. And so the fallback is we have to look at that. We have to look at that. We have to understand that we can't have it all lined up. That's not really what life is about, lining things up. And this inevitably takes us to another false assumption, and that is that we place so much meaning on our life or through our life, and yet our life ends. So how much meaning can it possibly have? So then you say, well, what's really meaningful is about my children, is about my property, my status, my prestige, the book I'm going to write, whatever. And as I mentioned in a previous talk on meaning, death shows us that assumption of meaning, that dependency upon life to be meaningful to us, can only carry us so far, because eventually we have to separate from that meaning, or the meaning separates from us. Because if whatever you put in your left hand that's meaningful, you have to put and look at your right hand, which is death, and see how those two hands, when they're coupled together, serves your general purpose and intention of living. For what the heart really wants is not dependency upon things for its meaning, which is usually what we think of, our status, our prestige, our wealth, but rather it's to abide within life itself as meaningful. Because when we are fully awake, when we are alive to the moment, when the resonance of stillness, if you can just take a moment and feel it as we speak this, as the resonance of stillness begins to be felt, what happens within that is that all of life is meaningful. You don't even, the question of what is meaningful in the awake state falls away. Because we're not, it has nothing to do with me looking for, searching for meaning. Because when we abide within life, everything is always meaningful. There's nothing outside of it that holds a critical evaluation and about whether it's meaningful or not. So Dharma practice takes us through, we have to be willing to go through what we think is so meaningful until we come to the meaninglessness of it all. And then something else can arise. And this is often the journey of the dark night of the soul, because we look around and things aren't as rich and purposeful as they once were when we lived dependent upon them. And then it suddenly breaks open so that life becomes meaningful on its own terms and for its own fact of being. Death also shows us that we are essentially nothing, and that all the images that we carry and all of the storyline that we have about ourselves is just in transition. And it's extraordinary, really, that at birth we start the story and we put so much weight and purpose in our storyline, who we are, what we can do, our accomplishments, our defeats, our comparisons, evaluations, all the sense of me. And then at the end of 70 years, we have to drop that story. And what good is the story if it has a beginning and an ending? What are we doing in the middle there? I mean, why don't we look towards those endpoints and say, is this story really necessary, one? And two, is it helping me really with the heart's deepest intent and purpose in life? And we'll see, and death shows us that it's more of a hindrance, way more of a hindrance than it is a help in that. In fact, the ending of our story is really the awakening of our aliveness. And as we begin to approach death more and more, we see that our story is always a thing of the past. It's already died. It's already, we just keep resurrecting our story in terms of the present moments and our ability. Then we hold ourselves in relationship to the present moment based upon the death of what we have done, what has already occurred. And so whenever we put our weight, we shift our weight towards something that has already died, like our previous experiences, then inevitably we're not going to be fully awake to what has already arrived, what is present. And I think that's important to begin to see. So now what about the psychological implications of death? It shows us, I think, more than anything, where we live in personal pain. And psychological death is the sense of the fear of isolation or abandonment, or the fear of loneliness, or being cut off, or being negated, or not being valued. All of those different psychological forms and manifestations of life that come at us that feel as if we're dying in that moment, and are in fact our psychological death, because we are being thrown back on the sense of a poor, impoverished sense of me. And I mean, it's interesting because we're we put so much weight and fulfillment and hope and connection with others, that through this this validation that we try and seek from others, relationships, the dependency upon relationships, of having relationships, for our own sense of validation, we look outward to see if somebody is recognizing and paying attention to me. And if they do so, then that is a sense of validating something in myself that I feel is either a very despairing, disparaging sense of me, or I don't feel like there's a strong, steady, grounded sense of me at all. So I look for others through relationship to validate myself. And that, of course, means that I'm going to be scared of being alone. I'm going to be scared of being cut off or abandoned or isolated from you. And so you have an enormous value to me and our relationship. And so I will adjust myself accordingly to make sure that that relationship is sustained. And so we lose our sense of naturalness and ease within life because of that. Because aloneness to many of us means not being appreciated. Being cut off when I'm alone is somehow we fall back on the sense of being unappreciated. That we don't count somehow. We don't count. And that is just too bad. So a sense of abandonment is another psychological death when we feel abandoned or isolated, no ground under our feet. Oftentimes, if we've had a childhood in which we've moved again and again and again, or had multiple relationships, then when we're back into that isolated state, we feel abandoned and we feel purposeless. Again, it's a lack of a ground or lack of rootedness, often because we haven't had rootedness in our life. We've had multiple homes or whatever. Another psychological death that many of us feel from time to time is when we're getting to know someone and there is that moment of awkward quiet between us, where that relationship and there's a social anxiety associated with it. When a conversation naturally ends, and what we do within that space of its ending tells us a lot about how we face ourselves in isolation. And whether we fall back into the pain of myself, I have very little to offer here. The quiet is all about my faults and my deficiencies. Whether we can ever are willing to be comfortable in that quiet is a question, because most of us really aren't. So that's going through the physical implications of death, the psychological, being cut off or being isolated, implications of death, and now the spiritual implications. Of course, ultimately, the spiritual death is the loss of the mental image of me. How we know ourselves is, again, governed by relationships, how people know us and how we surmise that they perceive us. And also through our actions of speech and mind over our history and our images and all of that. In those images, we carry a tremendous sense of intentionality to perpetuate and continue those images. In fact, we try to arrest the forms of life, the experiences of life, so that our life can feel on hold, so that our life can feel steady, you might say, through the fixation and arresting of experiences of life. And that's why when we look out, we deny change, because change means that I can't be who I have counted on myself being when things are changing. That means that I'm changing along with them. And that has tremendous implications for us spiritually, because we become so dependent upon the forms and experiences and expressions of life to maintain our sense of a mental image of who I am, that we aren't interested in the stillness or the quietness that is held, that is holding these experiences. Even fear is arising in stillness. Everything is arising in stillness. But we're not interested in stillness. Stillness, in fact, represents my demise. The forms represent my continuation. I know about them, and through my knowledge, through my history with them, through my competence or incompetence with these forms and experiences of life, I maintain the sense of I. If I look at what it arises in, then in stillness, I can't lean on stillness. In fact, stillness absorbs me in some way that doesn't validate me. So I'm not interested in stillness. I'm interested in the experiences for self-verification. Now, this has tremendous implications because the holy, the sacred, is found not in the physical, mental experiences of life, but in that which holds life, the stillness that holds all things. If you look at it for a moment, the two, the stillness and the forms, I will call the moment and the now. The moment contains the experiences of the now. It contains the sight, sound, smells, taste, touch, and cognition of the moment. It contains all the expressions, everything we see, everything that all the appearances of life. And the moment changes because those experiences are changing constantly. And one moment is not like the next moment, and the next moment is not like the previous one. But what holds all of those fluctuations is the now. The now, or stillness, presence is another way of saying this, vitality, aliveness. When I say stillness, I don't want it to feel as if it's blankness. But what holds all of this is stillness. It does not change. The now stays unchanged as the moment progresses or regresses throughout its lifespan. And we don't honor the now because the now doesn't give us a place to stand. In fact, it represents our annihilation. The things of the now seem to represent and validate us. Now, the things of the now are changing, so we have to do some quick inner mental work of denial to keep things as steady as we can make them in the moment, so that we can pretend as if they are continuing and we will as well. So the way Dharma practice works is to first go back to the fluctuations of the moment, the experiences within them. Do not argue, and not argue with those. Don't be in conflict with them, which means not to deny them, which means not to place some abstract reality upon the real one. And then as we surrender to the moment as it is, then we go through the moment. If you have any objection to the moment, you can't go through it. To go through the moment of the experiences and to reach the now, that's the movement of Dharma practice, and that is the central direction of awakening. Awakening to the now, the ever, ever non-changing now that holds all things, that will forever hold all things. And the problem is that the nature of stillness, we have to acknowledge the presence of silence. We have to be willing to have a growing relationship with silence. And most of us are scared to death of silence for the very reasons that I've listed. The mind's constantly screams forth in silence. It's like being in a canyon alone and yelling constantly so that you can hear your echo, so that that confirms, that invalidates the sense of you as not being alone. Well, we do that inwardly through our thoughts. We constantly scream forth our thinking. Scream may be a little exaggerated, but we constantly put forth our thinking to hold us off as an abeyance, to give us some place to fall, some place to rub against, so that we won't fall and transcend into the stillness that holds the very thought itself. So noise keeps me safe. And we wonder why, when we sit down in Dharma practice, why there's so many thoughts. The silence seems to swallow me. And that perspective is very troubling because it shakes everything we know. So we force the world outside of our direct experience so we can fight with it and prevent our demise within it through our thinking. Our thinking is the birth of a separation from the now. It's the birth of the moment, and in the birth of the moment, there's this inevitable separation from the now. Now, on retreat, what we try to do is we try to bring that sense of silence and stillness to bear environmentally and inwardly. So we create an environment where it doesn't have a lot of distractions, so that we can begin to actually have a relationship to stillness and to quietness. And we immediately see, when we sit, even for 45 minutes or if we're on a retreat, our dependency on distractions, on drama, on noise, on speed, on those things which keep us blunted away from the now, and engaged, reactively engaged with the moment. And so the retreat, when used properly, begins to say, okay, well, I mean, all the words of Dharma are the sense of the orientation of going through these particular conditioned reactions of the moment into the now. So it requires us relaxing, allowing, letting be, saying yes to the experience, surrendering, letting go. All of those are words to cut the reactivity, to cut the argument, so that we can go through the moment into the now. Many of us are very unsuccessful in that attempt, may I say, and we have to keep going back and back, because we keep thinking of ourselves as being what we are trying, is having the retreat experience. The sense of ourselves is coming from the noise of the separation from the now that we create to separate ourselves from the now. That's who the sense of me is. And we keep thinking that I have to get over this or get around this or get through this. And all that is more noise that we're creating in objection to surrendering and to stillness. So when we put no argument, add nothing to this moment, add no argument to this moment, just be quiet with it. What we then learn to do is to add quiet to noise. We don't add more noise to noise, because that, of course, just increases the dimension of conflict. We add quiet to noise. We don't do anything to the noise. And when we orient ourselves sufficiently to not doing anything to the noise, we become less predominant in the experience. The sense of me and all of the packaging and all of the story and all of the concept that I carry becomes quieter. And in that quietude, the sense of I feels more harmonious, more peaceful, deeper intimation of heart, affection, basic warmth. Why? Because then the universe can get into us. We are now quieting our noise. Our noise adversely affects our ability to open our heart. When and where we are able to be quieter and we're not having such objection to the noise, then the heart begins to open through the now. The now becomes porous. So it's only been us, it's only been our intentional obstructing the now that has kept life seemingly so distant. And why? Because we're afraid that the now contains our demise. And believe me, it does. And so what? If everything that is valuable to us is contained in our demise, then let the demise come. Why does it? What's all the frantic worrying about? What we lose is our story. What we lose is the assumption of I. We lose the assumption of self. That's what dies. How can the now die? The now is now. There is no death in the now. And so to come back into the now is to come into the deathless. To see life fully without noise, which obscures, constricts, obstructs everything that's meaningful. And if it means living without our story, what is the wonder that it presents? What's the value is that it gives us everything except our story. It doesn't mean you don't know yourself. It just means that you don't drag yourself moment after moment through the history into the present, into the future. Like we're being dragged by an automobile through the lanes of time. It just means settling. It just means relaxing. Just means ease and spaciousness and openness. Just means facing our death until we enter the deathless. And may all beings open to the deathless. Can we sit for a moment or two?